So I'm curious. I know that there's a few. Do we have any NASCAR fans? I knew Galen would be. Okay, we got a few. So it's interesting, you know, back in 1959, which was a couple years before Mark was born. Actually, it might have been after. Anyway, they started this race called the Daytona 500, which has become, in a sense, in NASCAR circuit, kind of the Super Bowl of NASCAR racing. What's interesting, though, is like the Super Bowl for football is the final game of the season. Well, in NASCAR, it's actually the flip-flop, where that first race of the season, the Daytona 500, is kind of the pinnacle of the season, and then it's all downhill from there, really is what it ends up being. But in 1960, Junior Johnson kind of did something that kind of revolutionized and changed the scene of NASCAR. So NASCAR racing is basically, they would take, originally they called it stock car racing, which they would take a car that was pretty much stock from the factory, and then they would basically make it unstock, and they would put in a bigger engine, but the whole chassis, in a sense, was, in a sense, the stock original. And then they would begin to race them, so that's where the stock car kind of became known in. But what Junior Johnson did in 1960 was he was racing in this Daytona 500, the second ever Daytona 500, and it was obvious that his Chevrolet was inferior to the other cars in the track. And yet, somehow he won. And so it was like, what in the world is happening? Well, he discovered something, that if he chose to follow the car directly in front of him close enough, he actually would gain speed, and his car that was inferior would actually go faster. No, just a note, the Chevrolet was not an inferior, you know, manufacturer, because as you look at the numbers, I think there was 32 Daytona 500s have been won by a Chevrolet, and Ford was like 17, and Dodge, sorry, Ted, was only 8. And Toyota has won just recently. So Toyota's got on the upswing. But it's interesting. So what ended up happening is this Junior Johnson, he created what was became known as the draft. And the draft basically is what you do when you're like, you're driving from, you know, Detroit to Minneapolis, and you want to make one stop and one stop only, and you have to plan where that stop is, and you only have so much fuel to get there. And so you end up pulling up right nice and close to a semi truck, and you just hang there forever because it breaks the wind for you. So this is kind of the draft in particular. So here's this clean air coming at the cars, and then once you get inside of this pocket, and there's turbulent air back here, it actually makes you go faster. And so by these three cars lined up here, they're going to leave this guy totally in the dust. It's a fascinating concept. There's this picture. The closer that they follow together, they're really the better off that they are, the more competitive they are. And that's what Junior Johnson kind of developed in 1960 with this idea, this concept of the draft. And it's being used all over today. You know? Some people who, you know, it's hard to bicycle in the wind, I'll give you that. And so if you can get behind a big old semi like that and go 50 miles an hour, talk about the bananas per hour, you know, you can really, really make hay. But it's interesting. So this draft that Junior Johnson developed, I mean, it's being used all over. You see it in cycling. If you watch the Olympics this past Olympiad, you see Jessica Diggins, one of the Nordic skiers, they would draft behind each other as they're racing on these skis. I mean, this happens all over. Track and field. If you are familiar with track and field, specifically even in distance races, these long distance runners, and long distance in track and field is like the 2 mile, which isn't very long. I realize that, especially if you're a marathon runner. But this reality, so in certain circumstances, they will sit there behind the people in front of them, basically just following into this little pocket, following nice and closely. It's really remarkable to watch sometimes, because their foot, you know, their feet are actually in rhythm with the guy in front of them. If the guy in front of them missteps, the whole line is going down, you know, because they're literally following that close, and they're just following each other around the track. You know, it's interesting to note, because of this idea of the draft and making, you know, best use of your miles per gallon in racing and even in running like that, you would think that as time has gone by, that your fastest times, like in the racing, the Daytona 500 would be more recent, and that's not really the case. The fastest time for the Daytona 500 recorded was actually, average speed, was in 1970. You know, and since then, no one has beaten that time. And so what it means is basically people will sit in there and they're going to follow that person right in front of them, follow them nice and closely, because it's the most fuel-efficient way to do it. Then they can slingshot and they can pass them in that way. But you see this idea of speed skating, track and field. You see it in cycling. You see it in Nordic skiing. All these different ways that people have employed this reality of following closely for the purpose of winning or excelling at what they're trying to do. And it's really cool to watch. It's really cool to understand that concept. So I wrote in my email yesterday, if you did not get the email, I'll tell you the story in a nutshell. But what ends up happening is my family, we grew up, we were deer hunters. We still are, at least some of us are. And I know I put this in there too. My older brother used to deer hunt, and then he realized that it's cold when you go deer hunting, and he chose not to go deer hunting anymore because it's cold. He doesn't like to be cold. He doesn't like to get up early in the morning. That's the two things for him, and obviously for deer hunting, those are two, you know, that's what you'd like to have. It's a reality. So instead of going deer hunting, he chooses now to go ice fishing early with his friends because he just likes to hang out with people that he likes. Yeah. Yeah, what is that? Anyway. But there's this reality. So as we'd go get ready for deer hunting, we would go up into the north woods. So we'd head up north here in northern Minnesota, a couple hours from here. And we would basically work on the stands. But what ended up happening is we would do this at a very young age. And my dad was the one. We'd follow him, and we'd go into the woods. And he knew this woods really well. He had been hunting in it for years. And we'd follow him, and there was this time where as we're following my dad, and he'd make some marks on some trees just to kind of, so he could find his way better in the dark, because you have to get up early as you're moving. And so we're following him. My dad's in the lead. I'm next, and then my older brother's behind. And as we're walking, suddenly there gets to be this, you know, calling from behind me saying, "Dad, Dad," a certain sense of panic in his voice. And so I turn around to look, and where my older brother is supposed to be, there's no one there. You know, he's missing. I mean, he is lost in the woods right now. We can hear him, but I have no idea where he's at. And my dad just basically, you know, stops me where we're at, and he calls out to my older brother, "Keep calling for me. You know, keep saying, keep talking." And so then my dad follows his voice, and we go back a little ways. It didn't seem like it was too terribly far, but here's my brother in a panic, not knowing where to go. And my dad says to him, "You did the right thing. You know, you stopped going the wrong direction. You started calling for me, and then I came." And now he gave some more instructions. He says, "Now you need to be aware and follow me in such a way that you don't lose sight of me." You know, my dad knew a trail. I mean, to us, it's like, I don't even see a path. And yet he seemed to know where he was going. And so he says to my brother, "Make sure that you keep me always in your sight." And that leads us to what we find here in Hebrews chapter 12. I couldn't help but just pass, you know, look at this. And this also goes with so well what Lane was praying right at the end of our worship set here. Because look at this. So in Hebrews chapter 12, and this is written kind of about, in a sense, this is immediately following in Hebrews chapter 12. It's immediately following this great statement of all of these pillars of faith over the Old Testament and the New Testament, all these men and women of God who chose to follow Christ, chose to follow God. And now look at this, what we have here. So he writes, "Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses," and these witnesses, this is like the competition. It's like you're sitting in there in a race watching, but this great cloud of witnesses are not just anybody. This great cloud of witnesses that this passage is talking about are those people who have gone before us. So when we're looking at this passage, what it is saying, you have all of these people who have gone before you, watching you now follow the path that they had followed, and these people are the ones that are cheering you on. This is the picture that you get. It's really remarkable. It says, "Let us throw then, since all of these people that have gone before us are looking in a sense and saying, you can do this, keep on, you can do this, since they're all cheering us on, let us throw off everything that hinders us, all the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race that's marked out for us." And you look at this. "Fixing your eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith." And so what that's really, in a sense, saying is, obviously, we don't miss this idea of keep your eyes on Jesus, but what it's also saying is, you look at all these others, these pillars of faith from the past, just as we were focused on Christ, he's the one that began it. We were following him the whole time. Now, you can kind of follow the path that we laid out for you, too, but it's because we were following him. It all works together in that sense. And so when we see someone that's following Christ, we can also follow after them. Like my son or my brother is saying, being told by dad to make sure you keep me in sight. Fix your eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, for the joy that's set up before him. Look at this. For the joy of having you follow him, to experience him, to be with him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame. You know, if you're worried about being shamed, I don't think you need to. Because here's Jesus Christ hanging on a cross, naked. If there's ever a shameful moment, that was probably it. And yet he took the cross and he emptied it of its shame. And he sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him, consider Jesus, who endured such opposition from sinners that you will not grow weary and lose heart. That is a picture of what we're going to see in this Gospel of John this morning. It's what Jesus did right then and there, and what we are told to do, and as far as keeping your eyes on Christ. And so if you're just joining us, if this is your first time with us, or you've maybe missed a few weeks, we're going through the Gospel of John. We started in John chapter 1. We are up to John chapter 18 right now. It's been a long road that we have been working together on getting there, but it's a really amazing passage, a really amazing picture, because what you find in the Gospel of John is what Jesus is laying out and John is recording is Jesus who he says he is, and if he is who he says he is, then our lives ought to be different. We ought to be transformed if Jesus is, in effect, who he says he is. And what John records in this Gospel of John that he wrote about Christ's life is like Jesus says he's the Son of God, true or false. And we have the decision to make, do we believe it or do we not believe it? And if we say we're going to believe it, then our lives not only will reflect it, but they will be transformed by it. And that's what we're going to hit this morning, because you're going to see this life in this person of Peter, who's been with Jesus for these last 3 years. He would be one of these ones that we would consider, if you would, a pillar of faith. And yet watch this person, what he's known for, obviously, but watch this person, everything that he stood for, everything that he believed, watch him fail. And don't tell me that you can't find some kind of a parallel in your own life, because you know where you've been. You know how you felt like, there, I'm actually growing in Christ. And then you find it's like, I just failed. And you feel like I've done nothing to grow. And you can't tell me that you can't somehow relate and understand what Peter was going through in this. And so we're going to look at that much closer today. So we left off here last week. Jesus was just arrested, all right? Here was Jesus. He was arrested. He was taken into captivity. There were 600 Roman soldiers there. There were some chief priests, some other priests, and some servants of the chief priests. They were all there, as well as Judas, who's the one that betrayed Christ. He was one of the disciples. And notice the contrast between Judas and Peter this morning as well. You know, if you know Judas's story, obviously he was with Christ as well, but there's something different, because he obviously betrayed Christ and failed. Peter also denied Christ and failed, but there's something going on that's different. There's a transformation that's a little bit deeper that I want us to be able to look at and see. So looking back now, as we get started, what we're going to do is we're going to look at several of the Gospels that we find in the Scriptures, and they're going to point to this prediction that we're going to be talking about today. They're pointing back to this prediction that Jesus said was going to happen, okay? So Jesus said, this is before his arrest, this is what he says is going to happen. He says, then Jesus told them, he's telling his disciples this very night. Remember, we just had this supper together? Remember how I washed your feet and I taught you these things? I prayed for you. This very night, okay, before this night is over, they're already eating and it's nighttime. This likely happened this moment here before 11 o'clock p.m. Come 1 o'clock a.m., things are totally different, okay? This very night, you will all fall away on account of me. For it is written, this is prophecy that Jesus is fulfilling. For it is written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. We find that in Zechariah 13. This is the prophecy that Jesus is referring to that is then fulfilled. It says, awake, sword against my shepherd, against the man who is close to me. Talk about a relationship that's close to God, Jesus Christ. And obviously we're supposed to be the ones that follow him, abide in him. And we see that. Then we grow and be connected with God in that same way. The man who is close to me declares the Lord Almighty, strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. And that's exactly what we're going to see fulfilled. In John 16, this is again before the arrest. And this is what Jesus had promised. He says, a time is coming, and in fact has now come, when you will be scattered. All right? We're all together. We've been together now for about 3 years. Soon, in fact, before this night is even over, you guys are all going to be scattered. Remember, we talked about those things that the disciples were worrying about, okay? When Jesus says, do not be troubled. They had a lot to be troubled about, and this is one of the things. Jesus has just said, everything's changing. He said he's going to die. He said that we're going to be scattered. I'm going to be left all alone. It's just remarkable. He says, you will be scattered, each one of you to your own home. You will leave me all alone. Yet I am not alone, for the Father is with me. And Peter has a reply to this. And this kind of sets the stage for what we're going to talk about this morning. Peter's got a reply. Peter's one of those guys, he think he had a reply for everything. You know, Jesus says something. Peter was almost always the first one to say something or to do something. He was extremely impulsive. You know, some of you perhaps are also very impulsive. When we had to do a premarital inventory when Sarah and I were first married, and I was off the charts for impulsive behavior. Okay. So you see this graph, there's this graph, and at the top was like 40 was the highest score. And so most people just kind of fluctuate. Mine went like this and then literally went up to 40 and then came back down. As he said, I've never seen anything like that. I said, give me that. It's not true. Some of it's true. So it says, Peter's got a reply. He's got a reply for everything. Here's what he replies. He says, Peter replied, even if, catch the passion. And I think that Peter totally believed what he was saying. I don't think Peter was trying to stage himself in any way. I think he 100% believed it. But Jesus knew something deeper. Jesus knew something better. So look at what Peter has to say. Even if all fall away on account of you, Jesus, I never will. I am that committed to you. Have you ever been that committed to Christ? Or at least thought you were? In John 13, it records it this way. Peter asked, Lord, why can't I follow? Jesus said, where I'm going, you can't follow. Peter's, again, has something to say. He says, Lord, why can't I follow you? I will lay down my life for you. You let me follow you, I'll follow you right up. They're going to kill you. I will be right there with you, and they can kill me too. I am that committed to you, Jesus. And I think Jesus knew something a little bit deeper than Peter did. And if you remember, we talked about this last week in Matthew 26. There's this picture. Jesus goes off to pray. And every time he comes back, he finds his disciples are sleeping. And he kind of, it comes across like Jesus is like, what's wrong with you for sleeping? Well, we understand it was late at night at this time, somewhere between 11 p.m. and 1 a.m. So they're probably tired. And so I get that. But Jesus understood something much deeper. And so Jesus comes back one time, he finds them sleeping. And he says that, watch and pray. I know what's about to happen to me, and I know what's about to happen to you. He says, watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. Jesus knows exactly what temptation they're going to face. He knows exactly what temptation Peter's about to face. He said, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Take a moment. Meditate on that last line. Because that, let's be honest, we've been there. We've experienced that. Our spirit is willing. We want to follow Jesus. But doggone it, if our flesh isn't so stinking weak. And we find ourselves right in Peter's shoes that we'll see today. Oh, I blew it. Your spirit is willing. You long to follow Christ closely. But what you find is you keep him at a distance. And I think that's what Jesus wants to transform in us this morning. Then Jesus answered. So Jesus obviously replies back to Peter. And Peter said, I will lay down my life for you. And this is what Jesus had to say. We talked about this a number of weeks ago when we covered John chapter 13. It says, then Jesus answered, will you really lay down your life for me? Peter, really? I know a little bit more of what's going on than you do. And you say you lay down my life for it. Really? Will you? He says, very truly, I tell you, this is the same night, before this night is over, before the rooster crows, before this night ends, you, Peter, individually, will deny me three times. You will disown me. You will say, I don't even know who this Jesus is. And Peter had just said, I would die for you. Matthew 26 put it this way. Truly, I tell you, Jesus answered, this very night before the rooster crows, you will disown me three times. But Peter declared, he's got a rebuttal for everything. Even if I have to die with you, and he says this after Jesus had said, you will disown me. Okay? So he says, I will die for you. I would go to the ends of the earth for you. I will follow you, even if it means a threat on my life. Jesus says, really, Peter, you're really going to do that? You say you're going to die me, but really die for me, but you really believe that? Because I got to tell you the truth. Before this night is over, you're going to deny me three times. And Peter says, are you nuts? Have you lost your mind, Jesus? Do you not know how committed I am to you? And he says, even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you. I would never do that. We're like this, Jesus. You should know me by now. We've been together 3 years. I would never disown you. And all the other disciples, we miss this one a lot of times, all the other disciples said, yeah, we're with Peter on this one. We're with you, Jesus. I just got to say, and this is easy for me to say because we're disconnected from it in this culture, obviously, at the time then. But if Jesus says something, and this is what I've learned over the past, I'm pretty sure he's telling the truth. And so when Jesus says, you will scatter and you'll disown me, this is obviously like hindsight, okay? We get the picture, full picture here. I was like, oh, I bet you're right. But here we have Peter and the rest of the disciples. And the rest of the disciples said, I think Peter's right on this one, Jesus. Sorry, Jesus, I think you're wrong on this one. I mean, you've been right on about a lot of things so far, everyone that I can pick so far, but I think you're wrong on this one. It's really what the disciples are saying. Luke puts it this way. And this is powerful because this gives a little bit different level to really what's going on. Because right now, all we've seen so far is Jesus telling Peter and the disciples, you guys are going to be scattered. Peter, you're going to disown me. And it's almost just like, what's wrong with you? You know, you shouldn't mess up. But there's a much deeper spiritual implication. And Luke shows us what that deeper spiritual implication is. Here we go. In Luke 22, it says this, Simon, Simon. So he's saying, Peter, Peter, we've just had this discussion. And he says, Satan has asked to sift all of you as wheat. Some versions just say, has asked to sift you as wheat, but the proper understanding is this idea, it's plural. This idea is, Satan has asked to sift all of you guys, all you disciples, Satan has asked to sift you, not just you, Peter, but he is talking directly to Peter, because this Peter's the one that's always got the answer, okay? So he's saying, Peter, Peter, Simon, Simon, Satan has asked to sift all of you guys as wheat, but I have prayed for you. I love this. Jesus knows the temptation that Peter is about to face. He knows the temptation that all of his disciples are about ready to face. And he says, but Peter, you guys are all going to be sifted, but I've prayed for you. And what does he pray? That your faith may not fail. And when you have turned back, strengthen your brothers. That is powerful. But he replied, as Peter usually does, Lord, I am ready to go to prison with you. And Jesus answered, I tell you, Peter, before the rooster crows today, you will deny me 3 times. You will not even say that you know me. And so here's this idea, is a sifting, and we don't really grasp it, because in our culture, we look at sifting as like this, okay? This is a sifter. You know, what we use a sifter for is maybe sift flour. Does anyone really sift flour? You're making cookies? Let's be honest. Anyone? No one. What we use, we have a sifter at home. This is our sifter. You know what we use it for? We make our French toast look powdery. You know? Oh, how sweet. It's just light and fluffy, and we decorate our French toast with it. We'll decorate our waffles, whatever the case is. And so we have no idea what this sifting really is. To us, it's just like, oh, it's just a little fluffing. But the reality of it is, this is much bigger, much deeper, that we just don't have a concept for. And some of you may know what it takes to actually sift wheat. You know, but there's actually 3 processes or 3 steps involved in this process. And oftentimes they use these old machines that you'll find sitting in farms all across Minnesota. My neighbor had, I think, several of these sitting in his field. They never operated. Apparently they were just like, you know, lawn ornaments for the most part. I've never seen one work. And I remember as a child driving by these things, and I would ask, what is that machine? And Dad would say, that's a thresher. What does it do? It threshes. You know, and nobody really had this concept as to what works. I realize there's probably many of you that do. So I did do justice, and I thought I should at least know what this thing does. Finally, now that I'm 42 years old, I should at least know what a thresher does. Well, bottom line is, you put wheat in this case that Jesus talked about. My understanding is other grains would work here too. I don't know. You can correct me later if I'm wrong, but for the sake of the argument, this is what we're talking about right now. So you put the wheat in the one end, which really being vulnerable here, okay? You ready? Because I could be totally wrong, all right? I think this is the end you put it in, okay? 50-50 on that one, right? Okay. If you've tried to put it in the side, it's just really not going to go well. So you put this wheat in. What ends up happening is as this wheat goes in, and if you understand what wheat is, if you ever don't mow your lawn, eventually your grass gets tall enough and it forms these little heads. You know, you think that would be good for your lawn because then those seeds then would fall off at some point and actually reseed your lawn. It doesn't do good. More weeds come up then instead. I don't really understand the principle of it, but I would advise you to keep cutting your lawn. Anyway, if you let your lawn go long enough, you get these heads on the end of your grass, okay? That's in a sense what we're looking at. So you would cut down the wheat and you would take this wheat and you would throw it into, 50% sure, this end. And then what ends up happening is it kind of pulls it in and it beats it. I mean, it just threshes it, okay? You understand with the idea, a thresher? So it literally, it beats it apart. And as it beats it apart, then this is my thinking here, okay? It's got some wheels and things like that. It looks like something from Dr. Seuss book, doesn't it? Right. You put the sneeches in here and they pop out over here. They had one star when they went in, now they have none. And then eventually they have some on their backside and three on their front side. Okay. So anyway, you put the wheat in and it threshes it. It just beats it up and then it starts to basically sift it. So it allows certain pieces to pass through this sifting process involving shaking and rotating and things like that. It wants some of the stuff to through, but it's this idea of flipping and beating and beating and beating. And eventually then this moves through, I believe, this pipe here, because that's got to do something, right? So I believe it moves through this here, and then what ends up happening is you actually have this fan that's designed to blow, and it's designed to blow all that isn't wheat away. It's called the winnowing. Okay, it blows all the wheat, and so then that wheat then would continue to fall into whatever bin you have. And maybe that rotates, I don't really know. Okay, I'm not a farmer. Just play one on TV. Okay. But that's how it works, you know, since the modern invention of the thresher, which that was a super modern one. That I'm sure that was just invented a couple of days ago. But before that, what they ended up doing is they would take, you know, different ways they would thresh it. So they'd start and they would lay out the wheat or the grain, and they would take either rods or sticks, and they literally would beat the grain, beat it and beat it and beat it, trying to really knock off all that's grain from the heads of the wheat or the barley or whatever grain that they're dealing with. All right, sometimes they would actually take the wheat and they would throw it onto what was called the threshing floor, and then they would have animals walk over it continually. Could you imagine being under the foot of an ox over and over and over again? If you were ever a heavyweight wrestler, maybe you experienced that. At least that's what it felt like, okay? But there's this reality that is just this beating, 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 beating over and over again. That's just to knock it loose. And then they would scoop up all of this grain and the dirt and the chaff and everything else that was there, and then they would put it into a great big sifter. It had small holes on it, but this isn't just like one of these little sifters with little, you know, soft screens, etc. This was something that was intended to be shaken vigorously, throwing the wheat all over the place, allowing certain things to pass, and if the wheat was true, it was actually actual grain, then it would hold on. Its faith, if you will, was strong enough to kind of remain in there. And then it still wasn't done, because then they would take it and they would pour it out in the wind, or they would toss it in the air and allow that chaff to be blown away, and so that all you're left then is wheat. But it was quite the process. And so really, in a sense, what we're finding is when Jesus is telling his disciples, guys, listen to me. Satan has asked to sift you as wheat. I think what he's really meaning is he's asked to really put you through this whole process. He's asked to beat you. He's asked to kind of put you, run you through the mill to see if you have the faith that it is to hold on. And what we see Jesus praying, I have prayed that your faith will remain even throughout the beating. And let's be honest. There's times in our lives where we feel we're being beaten. Sometimes we feel like the beaters are the ones even that are closest to us. And they're just, oh, why are you doing this to me? Sometimes it's maybe coworkers. Sometimes it's maybe our own circumstances. Maybe it's just life circumstances. And you just feel like you're constantly, like all that's happening, these sticks keep whacking, whacking. And then the next thing you know, you're being shaken vigorously with a sifter. And then all you feel like, all I want to do is fly up in the breeze and blow away. And that, through the midst of that, we see Christ telling his disciples, hang on, stay true to the gospel. And so then what we find here in, and this won't take long. I know we're just getting to John 18 now, but it's okay. I need to take up a little extra time just to make sure Chris has the chili ready, because it's a couple things. Number one, no one wants to eat lunch at 10:30, right? And number two is no one even wants to eat cold chili. So I want to keep him, make sure it's hot. Unless he's already served it in bowls, and it will be cold. And then I apologize. Okay. So here's what we have. The sifting is about ready to begin. Here you have John chapter 18, verses 15 and 16. This is where it begins. Simon Peter and another disciple. Jesus has just been arrested. All right, he's gone. I think I have his path. Oh, jump ahead. Okay. So here's this idea. Jesus was over here in Gethsemane. He's been arrested. Now he's down into this area here. This is the house of Caiaphas. He's actually at the house of Annas, first and foremost, who was the original high priest. This is his son-in-law, who's actually an illegitimate high priest. And he's going to be in both places in just a little bit, but we're going to back up here. Okay, so Simon Peter and another disciple who's believed to be John, the author, he always refers to himself almost in that third person capacity. He says, Simon Peter and another disciple were following Jesus because this disciple, the one that's not mentioned, was known to the high priest. This is John. He went with Jesus into the high priest's courtyard. So here they come. They're coming up to the high priest, Annas. They come up to his courtyard, and Peter stops outside the courtyard. Okay, he doesn't go in. We don't really know why. It sounds like maybe he wasn't maybe allowed, or he just chose not to, and John goes in farther. But then what we find is, but Peter, who had waited outside the door, the other disciple who was known by the high priest, came back, spoke to this servant girl who was on duty there, and brought Peter into the courtyard. But what we find, and we read these other accounts, so they go into the courtyard, Peter stays at the courtyard, and John goes further in to actually be with Jesus during these trials. And we'll be covering these trials more so next week. Matthew 26 puts it this way, but Peter followed Jesus at a distance. And I think that's one of the critical mistakes that Peter made. He followed incognito, if you will. He didn't want to get caught. Maybe he was afraid. He had just cut off someone's ear. That's usually frowned upon in most cultures. But Jesus had healed it, and so there really was no basis for Peter to be in danger in this sense. There was no evidence saying, hey, you cut off so-and-so's ear. Yes. Well, it's healed now. Well, I guess you're good to go. I mean, there's really nothing there to hold Peter, but there could have been some fear in regards to that. Don't really know. But Peter followed him at a distance, right up to the courtyard of the high priest. He entered and sat down with the guards to see what the outcome was. He stopped in the courtyard. As he's there, the servant girl is the first to encounter him. A servant girl. It's a slave. And we don't know whether she's Jew or Gentile. I don't know that makes a huge difference, but there is this idea of this lowly servant girl who now challenges Peter, and he can't stand up to a servant girl. I mean, it's really striking because here's this man who has just said to Jesus, I would never fall away. I will follow you even to the point of death. You know, and let's be careful here because this is what we remember Peter for the most. So who was Peter? Oh, he's the one that denied Christ three times. Remember that? But don't forget, Peter was also the one that was the first one to actually call Christ, the Son of the Most High God. Remember that? Way back in the Gospel of John, in fact, I think it was. Peter was the first one to say it. All right? He was also the only disciple who was allowed to walk on water. That's pretty cool. You know, and he was also one of the three disciples who were actually allowed to witness Jesus' transfiguration. You know, those are some amazing experiences that Peter had. So let's not lose sight of that capacity and just focus on, Peter was the one that denied him. Yes, he did. And we're going to see more of that here this morning. So the slave girl says, aren't you the one? All right, notice the negative connotation. It's a negative question. It says, she's not saying, are you one of his disciples? She's saying, you aren't one of the man's disciples too. There's that also refers to that John was also there. Okay, it's not just Peter there alone. She's already seen John. She obviously knows that John is a disciple. There's something different between the two of them because John went in to be with Jesus. Peter stopped at the courtyard, and so she asks this question in a negative context, and she says, you aren't one of his disciples too, are you? Because that other guy is, obviously, I know that. But you're not one too. Very condescending, really, in its tone as far as who this Jesus is. You wouldn't. You're not dumb enough to follow Christ, are you? It's really, in a nutshell, what she's saying. Peter's reply is, I am not. Whew. Number one, as if that wasn't bad enough. It was cold. And the servants and officials stood around a fire. This was actually a charcoal fire, so there wasn't a lot of light. It's just kind of important to note because then they'll go with his accent versus what they actually see. It'd be hard to tell. You look at someone in dim light, hard to see, especially the older you get. It was cold, and the servants and the officials stood around the fire that they had made to keep warm. Peter was also standing with them, warming himself. So here he is, relative darkness, standing by the charcoal fire, trying to stay warm, certainly hurting for Jesus, curious about what's happening, afraid maybe for himself. Maybe he's got his, you know, robe kind of pulled up over his head. I don't know. And in John 18, verse 25, wait, did I skip a part? No, standing with him, warming himself. Verse 25. So what we did is we jumped to 25 because simultaneously what you have is Jesus on trial and the denials of Peter happening at the same time. And so John, when he records it, he kind of flips back and forth, almost like a good sitcom, soap opera, whatever you would be. So here we jump to 25, which is still the same scene. And it says, meanwhile, Simon Peter was still standing there warming himself. And so these people that are around him asked, you aren't one of his disciples too. Notice again, there's a negative. We've already seen John. You're not one of them too, are you? Peter denied it again, saying, I am not. One of the high priest's servants. And in Matthew's account, it actually looks like this is another high priest's servant, but a female, a girl, a young girl. One of the high priest's servants, a relative of the man who Peter, whose ear Peter had cut off, challenged him. Didn't I see you with him in the garden? You know, you always used to go to that Garden of Gethsemane. Didn't I see you there? Again, Peter denied it. And at that moment, the rooster began to crow. It's interesting, Matthew puts it this way. Look at this. The turmoil that's existing in Peter at the time. After a little while, those standing there went up to Peter and said, surely you are one of them. Your accent gives you away. He was from Galilee, and the Galileans probably had quite a strong accent that was, you know, noticeable for other areas of Jerusalem. You know, almost like Otford, Addison, and Amtia. See that movie? Never mind. Surely you are one of them. Your accent gives you away. Then he began to call down curses, and he swore to them, I don't know the man. He began to literally curse at these accusers. He goes on a tirade, basically flipping out, if you will, saying, I don't even know who this Jesus is. This is the same man that just hours ago said, I would never do that. Finds himself in the pit. I've just done it. Immediately the rooster crowed. Then Peter remembered the words that Jesus had spoken, and probably also remembered this reality, this truth that was said in Luke 22 that said, Peter, Satan has asked to sift you, I think was also in his mind. Before the rooster crows, you will disown me three times. And he went outside and he wept bitterly. Here's kind of where the rubber meets the road. We look at this story of Peter, and it's a very spiritual story because what you have is you have the enemy wanting to sift not only Peter, but wanting to sift the rest of the disciples. And likewise, if you're a follower of Christ, I'm totally convinced that the enemy also wants to sift you. He wants you to be beaten. He wants you to be shaken. He wants you to basically find yourself in a point where he has discredited you and your testimony. He wants to wreck you. He knows he cannot take away your salvation. He has no power to do that. But he does have the power to affect your disposition, how you're viewed by others. And so he wants to totally undermine it. He believes, the enemy believes, that if I punish you enough, you will turn your back on God. He believed it about Job. Remember? Satan looked at Job and said, I don't think he's going to hold true, God, if I kind of take everything away from him. God said, you try it. Go ahead. And even through the midst of that, Job kept his faith. And this is what we're seeing here. And this is maybe the difference between Judas and Peter as well, because Judas did not make it through the sifter. He was proven to be unfaithful as he was sifted. But Peter holds on. It doesn't look like it because he fails, right? How did Peter hold on? He didn't quit on Jesus even after he failed. And this is the reality. You're going to mess up. You're going to do things that you thought you would never do. And when you do things that you thought you would never do, and you're finding yourself here weeping bitterly, saying, how can God restore me? How can God forgive me? How can God love me? Oh, what you find is a God who says, I knew you'd do that, but I love you anyway. Look at this as we kind of wrap up. 1 Corinthians 10. I'm going to show it to you twice. This is the NIV, and then I want you to get the language from the Message version as well. It's just a little bit more of an intimate type version. This is what it says in the NIV, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 12 and 13. So he says, Paul writing to the church. So if you think that you're standing firm, in other words, if you think you got it all figured out, all right, you're standing strong, you're faithful. I've met many people in my life like that. So it's like, I've got this Christian thing figured out. I'm good. I don't sin anymore. That's not a problem for me. So if you think you're standing firm, be careful that you do not fall. Does that not echo Peter and what we just read? I mean, that's like pinpointing. Maybe Paul had Peter in mind at that point. I don't know. But there's a reality that sure looks like what Peter was, because he was so confident and yet he fell. Paul says, no temptation has overtaken you except what is common to man. That which mankind continues to fall for is a real temptation. And God is faithful, and he's not going to let you be tempted. Satan cannot sift you without God's permission first. And that's a little bit hard, because it's like, why would God allow this to happen? And I think maybe it's because when it's done, you finally have found, wow, the Lord is faithful. And my faith in him can be that much stronger because I've seen his faithfulness through the threshing. I've seen his faithfulness through the sifting. And God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, he will also provide a way out so that you can endure it. Look at what the message says. We are just as capable of messing up as they were. Don't be so naive and self-confident to think that you're exempt, because you're not exempt. You could fall flat on your face as easily as anyone else. Forget about self-confidence. It's useless. Cultivate God confidence. Isn't that cool? No test or temptation that comes your way is beyond the course of what others have had to face. All you need to remember is that God will never let you down. He'll never let you be pushed past your limit. He'll always be there to help you come through it. Isn't that incredible? I want to wrap it up with this. So in 1 John chapter 1, this is the same author as what we've just been studying in the Gospel of John. And this is what he says. If we claim that we are without sin, we deceive ourselves. In other words, you're crazy. If you say, I don't have any sin, I'm good, you've lost your mind. You have no basis by which to stand on that in regards to that. He says, then the truth is not in us. If we confess our sins, in other words, if we acknowledge, yep, I'm sinful. If we acknowledge that I'm a mess. You could even say it this way. Good news, you're a mess. And so am I. And God still loves us anyway. You know what I'm saying? If we confess our sins, he is faithful and is just and will forgive us of our sins and purify us from all unrighteousness. Peter came to the point where he recognized, I'm a mess. Everything that I held on to, I thought I was strong. And what he realized is, I'm not strong. And what he will see in the end, Jesus was strong. And we'll see that. Be excited for John chapter 21, because it's just fabulous the way he takes Peter and reinstates him that way. But here's Peter. He's been sifted. He's been threshed. He's been beaten. He laid out the temptations in front of him, even by a slave girl. And Peter could not stand up to the temptations. The slave girl was accusing him of being a follower of Christ. I mean, it shows just this weakness of Peter. Peter was weak. So are you. So am I. If we claim we have not sinned, we make him out to be a liar, and his word is not in us. He is faithful and just and will forgive us of our sins and purify us from all unrighteousness. Here's the thing. Satan is actively trying to beat you. And some of you right now are probably experiencing, I am feeling like I'm being crushed. I am feeling like I am just being squashed. And I don't think I have what it takes to hold on. I'm ready to be done. I'm ready to just throw me up in the air, let the wind blow me away, because I don't think I have what it takes. Some of you are probably experiencing that. Some of you probably have experienced that in the past. Some of you will be experiencing that. But there's a reality that I think every one of us at some point have, are, or will, or maybe all of the above, are experiencing this idea of being threshed. Satan's saying, let's see what you got. You think you've got it together? Let me show you how much you don't have together. And then let other people watch you, because when they see you fail, what's going to happen is they're going to turn away from the gospel too, because they're going to see you as an inconsistency and they won't be able to tolerate it. But what's beautiful is you have Peter here, totally an example of an inconsistency, and yet what Jesus does with Peter and reinstates him and shows him this kind of love, it's like that shows this picture that even through the midst of that, here's Peter, and he's chosen to give his life later on for the sake of Christ. He did exactly what he said he would do, not at the time that he said it, but he did exactly what he said he'd do, not by his own strength, but suddenly he realized that there's a bigger strength involved, and that was God's strength, Christ's strength in him. So if you're in the midst of the threshing, if you're in the midst of the sifting, be encouraged. God will not allow you to be pressed beyond what you can bear, and I know it feels like you're being, I can't bear this anymore. Hold on to the faith that God has given to you, that when all is said and done, here you'll be a true grain of wheat that has made it through to be an example of, look at this. I've been crushed. I've been beaten. And yet Jesus is good. And that is a powerful testimony that will not easily be forgotten. I'm going to invite Lane and the worship team up, and we're going to sing, and we're going to worship. We're going to worship this God who sees us faithfully through the threshing and the sifting. If you're experiencing the threshing, if you're experiencing the sifting right now, give it to him. You know, say, Lord, you got to take this. You got to give me the strength to make it through. It's not on your own strength because you don't have it, but let the Lord's strength be what carries you through it.